Welcome back for a second time. First of all, thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, first question, some overall thoughts on 2024. I guess it's always hectic in frontline, but do you have any broad topics you can share so far of 2024?
Well, it's a little bit comparable to actually last time I was here, because that's more or less 2 years ago, where we had the Russia invasion of Ukraine. Now we have had quite a stressful start to the year, basically due to the Houthi action in the Red Sea and the closing of the strait between the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. Also, again, questions about security for seafarers, rerouting of vessels, how kind of we as a responsible owner adapt to new kind of territory and new information. So I think kind of the theme for the start of this year, it actually happened before the end of last year, but it started to happen. The theme now has been political unrest, obviously a terrible situation going on in Israel and Gaza, but also how that kind of affects the tankers and how we trade.
I saw you had a comment that you said it's a proper mess. Is that so also like a summary take?
It is a proper mess. So we've obviously been throughout the period been advised by security advisors. It's actually quite normal for us to travel with guards on board when we pass the Gulf of Aden. And we use the same kind of resources basically to understand security. And we did pass with ships kind of early on in the conflict. That was when the Houthis were claiming to just focus on Israeli related tonnage. We don't have any kind of nexus with Israel whatsoever. We haven't had a ship calling on Israel. This is not for political reasons. It's basically just normal trading. As probably the audience can understand, having Israeli history in your loading or discharging schedule when your primary market is the Arabian world has been an issue for many years. So this is kind of not new to us. But we've had weekly calls with these advisors who are actually on the ground in Yemen, and obviously they have a better picture than we could ever get on this. And even they claim it's a bit of a mess because it's an unstable region. There has been between Saudi and the Houthis, they've been fighting for 9 years, or they're about maybe 10 now. And then you have this area is also bordering Somalia, which have been, had kind of fairly high piracy activity over the years. And basically what to understand this are, it's a lot of various kind of fractions with the one common theme is that they're, more or less, being backed by Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which is kind of the priesthood part of Iranian government. And so basically what we learned lastly or most recently is that the kind of Somalian pirates are providing intelligence to the Houthis in order to kind of try and figure out which ships to go after. So this is a mess. And also within the Houthis, there are various factions. They don't all agree, kind of. There has been, peace talks between Houthis and in Egypt in particular, in order to try and figure out a way to how this kind of situation can be resolved. And most recently, we learned that even if there was, Israel and Hamas, did kind of an agreement to lay down arms for a period of time, the Houthis did not necessarily guarantee that they were going to stop attacking ships. So it's very difficult kind of to orientate it.
So one thing is the actually, operations going on the ground and perfectly summarized by you. But if you go one layer back, big nations, politics, trade alliances, is there also like a bigger picture that is also at play that is very hard to truly know?
It is. I try to kind of focus on what's closest to my nose, to put it that way. So things that are related to kind of operating safely for frontline. But what we've seen is that So when you at the start had ships with Israeli Nexus that were attacked, then after U.S. and British forces attacked Yemeni sites where the Houthis were organized or placed or whatever, then you started to go after kind of U.S. linked companies, of which Frontline is very much so. We don't have a headquarter in the U.S., which seemed to be kind of the focal point on Eagle Bulk, for instance. They have their head office there. But still, we're a big U.S.-listed entity. So obviously, a very kind of tempting target if you want to be very public about your position in the market. And this has basically caused us to just decide, we can't go through at all.
Yeah. Okay, so let's switch gears a bit. You just had an investor call. How would you summarize what you told the market? Because it's been an interesting 2023, but also maybe the previous year, and now it's sort of things are getting into place. We'll come to Euronav afterwards, of course, but just the overall take, what was the main message in the latest investor call with to investors?
Well, the biggest thing that's happened for Frontline has been that the whole Euronav saga came to an end in October last year. We concluded on what's probably the biggest tanker deal ever done, in the history of the world. Basically, it sounds very
inflation adjusted, or
no? But I think enough. Close to $2.5 billion, 24 VLCCs in one go, modern units and all that. Very few such deals have been done. Of course, we've had M&A activity probably, but like pure shipping deal, it's a substantial one. And the key for us, although the markets kind of do what the markets do, we regretfully we can't control them. But so the key focus point here has been that without issuing one single share, we managed to kind of reorganize and refinance Frontline in a manner. We've kind of sold off a few kind of less efficient assets, which always been the plan, because Frontline has a fairly, we try to keep a modern fleet, efficient fleet. And in kind of that, we managed now to fully finance without the shareholder loan from Hemen. That was, should be more, or I think the market expected it to be more or less a bridge. But obviously, the market also then were a bit uncertain what's going to happen. Are we going to do a $500 million placement that would normally put a lid on your share price for a while? I think they came to a realization somewhere last year that that doesn't look like happening, also within our communications. And now, only within maybe a bit over a quarter, we managed to do the refinancing we told the market in our Q3 reporting we're going to do. Also, we managed to execute on selling less efficient assets. And now we're actually in a very strong financial position going forward. I think on that point, it's very, Frontline a bit differs a little bit from the other peers or the other listed shipping entities. We don't really see the need to aggressively kind of delever the company. The argumentation around the deleveraging is our LTVs are fairly low now, but that's obviously due to very high asset prices. So if you expect asset, if you expect us to be very high in the cycle on asset valuation, Frontline is potentially to have too much leverage on our books. So we can withstand easily a correction in asset prices by 40-45%. But in a kind of normal, very volatile tanker world, that is actually not necessarily a black swan. It's a grayish swan, but it's not a black swan that asset prices correct heavily. Well, then back to your inflationary kind of, or your point on inflation, we don't necessarily think that asset prices are kind of high in the cycle. If you do that calculation and look at, say, in Korea, which is kind of the benchmark shipbuilder of the world, they've had a cumulative since 2008, since the last peak we had on tankers, they've had about 20% of inflation, core inflation. So you could, in theory, if you're going to do $2008 versus $2024, Kind of where we are now is marginally mid-cycle at asset prices or new build prices, which are flirting around $130 million. The peak in 2008 was $160 million. And we're not even near. And if you inflation adjust it, we're actually hovering just north of $100 million. So this is why we're comfortable of having, LTVs around 50%. And we also believe that gives kind of our shareholders better return on equity and also, again, explains parts of the pricing that we're getting in the market.
Okay, so we opened the door on the Euronav transaction. So I have to just dive into that. Is it fair to say that we could spend many hours just talking about that deal because of the complexity, everything that went on? Or was it, in hindsight, a very smooth and efficient deal?
It was definitively not a smooth and efficient deal. Time kind of killed it in a way. When we chose to terminate the combination agreement last year, it was basically because we were not in a position to actually marry the two companies, which, kind of from the onset, this was a combination agreement. When you can't combine two companies, you can't get the synergies, you can't get the kind of the operational advantages that they're looking for. We were looking at a scenario where we, for a prolonged period of time, we probably had to run two companies in parallel, although management would be kind of and governance-wise, it would look like once. It would basically be two massive companies running in parallel with all the implications that have, even in how you price, kind of internally price services to each other and so forth. So it didn't really look very efficient to be that way. And why we ended up in that situation was obviously because the Savarez family and CMB had other ideas for the company. So I think kind of the solution we found in the end was, although a full-on merger at the time, effectively executed from when we made public with the term sheets, that would probably have been the best solution in the end. But now, when we ended up where we were with a blocking shareholder, I think kind of the solution that we found during the summer of last year, which came out publicly in October, I think that's the best we could. And it was good for CMB because they can execute on their strategy. It's good for Frontline. We are pure play tanker company. It's also shown, that was one of my points in my Q1 reporting, or our Q1 reporting was also operationally we're set up for this stuff. We increased our overall kind of sailing day footprint or fleet by 33% literally overnight. And the organization is able to adapt to that. And it's not like we need to go and hire 10 people or anything like that. We just add them to the platform. And, our, right now, all the vessels but one is sailing effectively on the Frontline flag.
So, but describing the solution you're telling us now, could that solution have been found earlier or very difficult?
Not really. No, it's and this is kind of from the onset. There were actually three parties to this transaction. So it was Frontline, it was Euronav, and then it was CMB. And obviously for Euronav, it would be extremely difficult to go to their shareholders and recommend a solution where you split the company in two, which is effectively what we've done. We bought close to 50% of the NAV of Euronav. So you can imagine for the Euronav, before CMB were in a blocking position, that was not really, actually these discussions were had back in October, a year back again in 2022, that must be, yes. When the realization came that CMB was not going to stop. So a bit prior to they reached the 25% threshold, there were three-party discussions where this was one of the potential solutions, which obviously Hugo and the board of Euronav could not, with a straight face go to the shareholders and say, guys, we're going to split the company in two. So at that time, we were still searching for solutions, how we could get the merger together, basically.
How easy is it to stay calm and collected working on this very complex deal, but on the other hand also need to deliver on existing, you know, vessels and metrics, etc.? Is that also very easy, or does it also, you know?
No, I think you have a huge advantage in frontline in that respect, and you know, I cannot praise kind of how we work as a company, or I would actually call it just a machine. And I think you know, you could joke about it that you know, frontline has had there's been new management in frontline quite a few times. You know, there's a history of fairly rapid kind of changes. But you know, to give an example, kind of, I believe I'm the sixth CEO the CFO is reporting to. So I think that the company is kind of used to having, obviously, a very, very lean organization. They're also very used to having top management change, you know, fairly often. But also that you know, kind of the overall strategy of the company is extremely known to every employee. You know, we're a company of professionals. Sometimes we kind of compare it to a law firm. This has to do with how the company is set up. You know, everything that is not core is outsourced. So it means that you know, the people that are actually hired by frontline are more or less regarded as managers, and they're all professional. They're all kind of has long experience both in frontline and in shipping, so they will just soldier on. So of course it's a little bit noisy when you read the newspapers and hear about this and that in the market, but I honestly don't think we've lost any momentum during kind of this you know, almost 2 years of negotiations and various kind of strategy paths. And it was always going to be so that you know, frontline would kind of remain, and you know, the frontline kind of business model was you know, going to be the one kind of leading on. So I think kind of the team at frontline has you know, and I'm you know, very, very respectful of that, been able to kind of just soldier on and do you know, the day to day work as efficiently as possible. So and now when this solution came on, you know, everybody's just super motivated to make this work as we go forward.
I think that's perfectly explained. And maybe also another analogy would be like a sports team, like the club stands, you know, managers and players come and go, but the DNA of the club is like the most important. So when you're dealing with difficult situations, it's not, you don't put your ego in it. Where should I be and what can happen to me? It's more like the machine, the DNA, and that's how the company maybe stays relevant for years after years, maybe.
Absolutely.
But it's harder to execute, you know, in practice than in theory. So there has to be a really strong core, but maybe that comes naturally from biggest shareholder down to the organization. So you can't really...
No, yeah. I believe you're right. But I also think the misconception might be that... and I had this as well when I joined Frontline back in the days, when you realize actually how small the core organization is. You know, we run, you know, close... Well, 89 ships, actually reducing a little bit now because we're delivering the ships we've sold. But, you know, the man years in the office is, you know, hardly 50 people. So you actually know everybody personally, more or less. So we're kind of a tight team. You know, operationally, commercially, technically, you know, everybody knows what their job is. It's not like having, you know, some people have you know, at least here in Norway, you compare kind of what's been going on to you know, you could mention kind of what happened with Kværner back in the days, and Aker and Kjellinger Røkke and so forth. Meaning that I could, in theory, write a book about the last 2 years, which I'm obviously never going to do. But those were big organizations, lots of people, you know, large implications to many. This has not been that at all.
Very good. So last time we did an episode, it's actually episode 132. You gave a lot of big lessons that the audience really enjoyed. But one part you spoke about was the frontline original memo, I think. And you said, you know, frontline is all about saying precisely where we are in the cycle and also, you know, executing.
Mm.
So if this tanker party is going on right now, where are we in the party? Like, is it early in the party? Should we stop drinking alcohol, switch to water, to just... Because you don't want to be the last one closing, you know, closing the party. So if you get the analogy, because it's been... This super cycle has been talked about a lot. And of course, you get sentiment, momentum. So where do you define this cycle in terms of where are we?
Well, I think we haven't, you know, we haven't even sat down for dinner yet, to be quite honest. So, and I've had this, you know, kind of for this analogy. And imagine, you know, we're having, you know, drinks first, then we sit down for dinner. Then obviously we're going to do some dancing and all that stuff. And in Norway, as you know, we do an after party as well. So we actually don't really go home until the sun is up. So, but we haven't sat down for dinner yet, I believe. And there's actually a few indications about, you know, kind of backing that, because over the last couple of months, we've had what some people would refer to as ordering frenzy. There's been a lot of Suezmaxes, a lot of VLCCs being contracted. You know, on the LR2 side, you could say they started much earlier. But not necessarily from a kind of market point of view, I think, because it's more relating to what shipyards can actually build the various asset classes. And the bigger the asset classes are, the fewer yards can actually build them. And VLCC is quite big, so you need the berth and the size kind of in order to do build. But looking at that now, so there's been a frenzy. 2026 is sold out. 2027 is actually starting to, I don't think it's sold out for any, you know, I still think there's possibilities, at least from certain yards. And if you move maybe what's at least perceived the lower quality yards, you could probably get a lot of stuff done in 2027. But, you know, that gives us, we're only, you know, in the first quarter of 2024. So, you know, there are a few years ahead of us. And also, if you look at how many ships who are not, you know, the kind of the aging profile of the fleet is only getting more and more prominent. You know, I think basically what we see now is that at least for the next few years, we're not really going to have any significant fleet growth in the bigger segments. On the LR2 side, yes. But LR2s, again, as I've said in my call and I've said a few times, LR2s, due to coating, tends to have a shorter lifespan than Suezmax and VLCCs. So you would more look at the 15-year threshold. And then we're actually in the generations that were delivered kind of late in you know, 2000, so 2007, 8, 9, which are big generations for LR2s. So basically, they will also have this kind of, the effectiveness of those fleets will be reduced quite heavily going forward. So we actually need those 45 or 50, whatever LR2s are on order right now. We need them to come. And we need the VLCCs, we need the Suezmaxes as well. Because I think if there's anything that's happened since we did this call the last time, is the recognition of the fact that the green shift is not happening quickly enough. And we, you know, we all obviously want alternative energies. We want clean blue skies. We want our children to grow up in a world, you know, with basically less pollution. But it doesn't happen as quickly as people would have wanted it to.
So in this equation where you have, you know, the order book, the vessels, and the market, it's fair to say that you're very comfortable with this market perspective since the order book. But on the other side of the equation, is that as easy and predictable? Because markets, you know, we can dive into, of course, the market perspectives, but there is a lot of unknowns, of course. So how would you like, if you take that equation?
This is definitively a supply story. So it's not a demand story. Demand is extremely difficult for us to understand or analyze. I think just the volatility in oil price itself, as I touched upon 2 years ago as well, is it's not a very efficient market. But I think kind of what we've seen is that overall energy consumption is going up. You know, incidentally, kind of around the time we had the call 2 years ago, DNV, you know, they give out their annual report, which is, I think it's called Vision 2050, no, sorry, 2050 or something. And where they try to analyze and try to give estimations of how the energy mix is going to look in 2050. And they also then have ideas about peak oil demand. You know, when does oil demand start to reduce, replaced? You know, everybody knows energy is demand is going to grow, but what's the mix going to be like, right? And 2 years ago, they actually had us being at the peak in 2019, 2020. Well, actually, to be fair to them, probably 21, because, you know, the assumption was that post-COVID, you know, the peak oil demand or hydrocarbons in the mix had peaked already. It's quite obvious that that never happened. So overall, energy demand does follow the, you know, the estimated path. And grows more or less with the population growth, and obviously with you know, people becoming more and more wealthy, actually affording to have an EV, for instance, or affording to you know, replace firewood with LPG, for instance, so that's happening, but oil as a part of the energy mix is not reducing; it's actually increasing. I think kind of. Most analysts and experts looking at this basically have to gradually readjust their models, and they see, and it's not like necessarily it's a disaster for the world, because we are actually capturing more of kind of the bad stuff from our energy consumption, but it seems to continue to grow, and you know, I think if you ask, well, if you look at is it BP that do their huge analysis? Then, you know, that kind of peak is starting to move closer and closer to 2040, even some putting it closer to 2050 now. So we you know, I think on average, last time I checked, last fall, I think the average, if you put all these numbers together from the various analysts, you know, we were peaking around 2037 or something. Now it's moving closer and closer to 2040.
Yeah, that's a very good point. But like you said, markets are very hard to predict. But taking that into account, what are some of the data and trends you are most curious about seeing playing out the next couple of years? Could be OPEC, could be US. There's a lot of things going on. And, you know, I feel like we're also in an environment that makes people a bit, or let's say it's attract leaders who want to make things happen, to say, to put it mildly.
I'm probably going to go on a whim now. But last time I was on your show, I didn't mention that I had a tendency to lean towards charts, statistics, and, you know, that stuff. I also have a kind of an underlying idea of markets being to some extent mean reverting. Obviously, you know, in just adjusted for in theory, it should be adjusted for inflation. But you know, with that, kind of what's making me very curious is the fact that we've had for a couple of years now, we've had this situation where the smaller asset classes, which are actually cheaper to build, are outperforming the larger assets, the classes, which are more expensive. And just for economical reasons, that should not actually be possible. You know, over time, you know, in a perfect world, you know, it's normally the costlier assets needs a higher return on equity or a return on investment. And then by time, you know, it either supply into that as a class will reduce until earnings get to that stage or return gets to that stage, or something else has to happen in order for this to normalize. And you have had this kind of rule of thumb that over time, you know, a Suezmax is supposed to make 30% more than less than a Suezmax, because the Suezmax is, well, used to be close to 30% more expensive to build. And then a VLCC again should make 30% more than a Suezmax, because again, it's more expensive to build. Now we've had for a very prolonged period of time, and if you were like a spread trader in the tanker FFA market, you'd be hosed for the last couple of years, because none of these truths have really been been present. So what I'm most curious about, will we return to this kind of normality? But you can to some extent say that the very aggressive ordering on the Aframax LR2 side is will potentially cause that segment to go back into line, where it actually is making 20-30% less than say a Suezmax, and you get some sort of normalization for that. I'm not saying that the markets are going to be low as an overall, but I'm just saying that we're probably, hopefully, going back to the scenario where, you know, a VLCC can kind of normalize around $70,000-$80,000 a day, Suezmax $40,000-$60,000 a day, and then the LR2 Aframax, you know, hovering $30,000-$40,000 a day, which is normally kind of where it's supposed to be. I think and it could be that we are seeing some signs of this. I tweeted the other day, just looking at the relative share of oil being loaded on VLCCs versus Suezmax and Aframax. We are actually now getting back to more normalized volumes in particular, so in the VLCC space. This obviously due to the fact that oil is now traveling a little bit further due to what's going on, in the Red Sea. So I think kind of this is going to be exciting to see. But I think just to lay one to rest first, you know. So again, this is a supply story; it's not a demand story. The demand story, we are starting to see that the demand for hydrocarbons doesn't look to fall off a cliff anytime soon. And then, since this is a supply story, although we're going to have a lot of volatility, we still see that we have this grind, where we are gradually making more and more money. We're also seeing very promising signs in the time charter markets. We're seeing, potentially the smart people in the room, oil majors, national oil companies. I'm probably going to be criticized for this. I'm not calling the traders that because the traders are, they have kind of a completely different set of risk parameters than, say, an oil major or a national oil company. So they might kind of go out on a whim, for other reasons than necessarily this kind of a big backdrop supply demand story on tankers. But we're seeing kind of the big oil majors engaging for longer term business on basically all asset classes, which is, I would assume is because they've made the analysis.
Yeah. So like you said, this is a supply story. And one topic I would love to cover a bit today is the increasing shadow fleet. It's been quite recent in the news, actually. And I guess there's always been kind of a shadow operation, but that has increased drastically since the war in Ukraine. I've seen many different references, but for easy numbers, maybe let's say there's 100 new tankers on the market taking Russian oil to Middle East, discounted. So this is becoming quite a big topic, or how do you view the whole shadow fleet narrative? Where are we, and is this also here to stay, sort of? Because the situation seems a bit locked, to say the least.
Yeah, no, it's, I've been kind of barking up this tree for a long time. That was more focused on Venezuela, Iran, North Korea, you basically just don't care about. But what's happened and what's changed is that ever since last summer, it actually started in May, but you saw it more pronounced during the summer, was when obviously the G7 oil price cap on Russian crude, you started to see Urals or Russian grades trade kind of consistently above the $60 cap. So ever since Russia invaded Ukraine, you've had kind of this growth in the gray fleet. And with gray fleet, I mean ships that are perfectly kind of doing what's within the sanction kind of framework. But obviously they're trading in Russian crude. So you could say that out of humanity or political views or whatever, they probably shouldn't. But they're still doing it, adhering to international laws. And that's what I, at least in my vocabulary, refer to as the gray fleet. And this fleet could very easily switch back and forth between kind of the all compliant fleet, to call that, and the gray fleet, the dark fleet. Those ships are, they're trading kind of molecules that are sanctioned. So there's no way back, kind of. But what's happened then since the price cap came into play, not into effect because that was earlier, but when it really came into play in earnest, you've seen various ways of how, you know, how do we, as a transporter of Russian oil, kind of on the paper adhere to the price cap, but still kind of get the oil transported. And this has created this where you're so borderline, you know, you've seen examples of, you know, oil being documented purchased below the price cap. But then, you know, the margin basically to account for the discount the Russian supplier has given, then you put an element into the freight in order to try and kind of adjust so that the oil is sold cheap enough, but still the supplier can gain kind of the real price for Russian crude. And this basically meant that more and more actors have stepped over the line, and they can't really in earnest document that they're transporting kind of under the current regulation. And this has basically made the dark fleet then grow. I was actually shocked when I saw the numbers. You're probably referring to the same, where an analyst or kind of a fairly big ship brokerage came out and said that the dark fleet now amounts to more than 700 vessels. That's a significant, you know, 8% of the overall tanker fleet. That's remarkable. But I've always said that, you know, we have the percentage of tankers that are above 20 years that trade, you could literally just regard them as dark fleet in the first place. And then add some more modern vessels that are obviously then controlled in this instance by Russian interests. I'm you know, what I'm surprised about is that we haven't been able to clamp down. Kind of, I know U.S. authorities are, you know, using considerable resources now. This could potentially be one of the game changers going forward, where OFAC, which is the U.S. authority that imposes the sanctions, that they're now starting to add to their lists of actors and owners that you basically shouldn't trade with if you want to stay within the sanction framework. It's made it hugely complicated for us as owners to kind of move around in this market. And obviously our you know, the time we spend on staying compliant, because the, you know, kind of the consequences of not can be very, very severe. You know, so the resources we're putting, you know, incredible resources on this, but you know, we haven't really seen it in the numbers yet that this is having kind of a big effect on the compliant fleet. But that way, in theory, you should move then capacity into kind of the dark world, less efficient trading patterns, and then obviously the all compliant fleet is going to have more barrels to trade. That we haven't really seen that significantly yet.
We're of course not going to give, you know, geopolitic predictions, but is there also a scenario in your head that the balance of power is shifting a bit, where you see one side of the world collaborating more and more closely, and maybe the other side has also internal issues, growth issues? So I think we're moving into a world that is not always based on the Westerners, to say it like that.
I had this question back in June. I did some, you know, an investor conference in New York, and got the question actually for the first time: what do you think about global polarization? And at the time, I hadn't really thought about it, I must admit. So, but I think sitting in the U.S., you view the world from a different angle, you know, it's a very kind of valid question to ask. So, you know, you have the Middle East, where obviously there's massive efforts in order to try and get this community together for some, you know, one way or another. And obviously it's a huge force in the oil producing world. And then you have China, you know, which you kind of are looking at things from a different point of view, spiced that up with Taiwan and China. And then you have US, of course, which politically, you know, kind of the price on oil is probably one of the most important things to them politically. And, you know, we've seen kind of, I've always said that I think kind of the strategy of releasing SPR barrels in the US, basically to avoid oil price to go up significantly when Russia invaded Ukraine, was potentially not the wisest strategy from a kind of geopolitical point of view. It did help US internally as keeping the oil price at the pump, you know, somewhat limited. But in the longer term, you know, you basically kind of, and this is the challenge, I believe, in geopolitics. And I know I'm talking about things I shouldn't now, but, you know, some countries have 10 to 20 years strategies. Others have 7 to 5 year strategies, but then another country, they have an election coming up in 5 minutes and need to deal with it. So and you know, that's where you see all this kind of, you know, but it's definitively something we need to kind of keep in the back of our heads. You know, an increased tension kind of between US and China, which are after all the two biggest kind of economical forces we need to kind of confront or stay in line with. You know, this could also kind of have effects on how oil is trading as well.
Definitely. Mm. So, but just to end that geopolitics topic, is it also just a truth that a more unstable world always tend to be good for frontline oil tankers? That's just like a given, even though it's hard to proclaim that and say that. Is it just like a truth?
No,
or can it also backfire?
But well, I wouldn't say frontline though.
Yeah,
I would say the overall tanker market.
Yeah.
Historically, yes. So you might have short-term disruptions that are obviously, you know, very bearish, but over time, inefficiencies in global trade. But this goes for shipping altogether. You know, imagine a scenario which potentially could be negative, of course, but imagine a scenario where, you know, China and US as trading partners, you know, it become more difficult for them. You know, it kind of goods and services needs to find another way. And what I think kind of in the whole globalization, and people are probably going to write books about that. That's kind of from early 2000 until now, we've actually yielded huge efficiency gains from globalization. It's actually been a good thing. People tend to forget that you know, the fact that you've much more efficiently and cheaper can you know, create goods in one place and transport it to another one in an open market has actually yielded efficiency gains, because it's not so that everything is efficiently built either in Norway, Sweden, or US, or, you know, it could be that it's more efficient to build it somewhere else. So and then transporting it, you know, gives you this gain. I think what's happening now is people are looking more and more after themselves. Also, we now have maybe something looking like, you know, energy policy in Europe, where you realize that maybe we can't rely on, you know, the whole world supplying us with, say, natural gas. And this is creating kind of new situations, but inevitably ends up benefiting freight, because it's an inefficiency. It basically makes goods travel further, and particularly so oil.
Definitely. That's a perfect summary. So we talked a bit about, you know, the deal with Yuranov. So if you can just set the picture going forward, given that we haven't sat down for dinner yet at this party and you have this fleet, can you just spend 1 minute to summarize what are we looking at today? That is, you know, a very, yeah, I don't know, have Frontline ever had this great fleet at its hands to play ahead?
We had it back in 2003, 2004, at least the sheer size. But then, you know, we didn't have the same kind of quality on the fleet at that time. You know, you didn't have all the regulations, and also the market wasn't really used to fuel being a significant cost. You know, people tend to forget this, but you know, oil price kind of above $100 per barrel was unthinkable back in the early 2000s. So it's but it kind of by earning days, we have those kind of, you know, we are in that situation now, and we were in that situation then. I think, you know, one thing that Mr. Fredriksen always kind of pulls up is 2004, Frontline made adjusted net income above $1 billion. $1 billion on the bottom line. That's even today, it's quite a bit of money. So it's difficult to predict. Actually, last year was the best year Frontline had in 15 years. I feel like it wasn't noticed enough, to be quite honest. You know, we haven't had such a tank year since 2008. But I think what's missing is that everybody are so excited about the VLCC, you know. So it doesn't really matter that the LR2s and the Suezmaxes, you know, made each $50,000 a day, which is actually, you know, unicorn territory on earnings over a prolonged period of time. But the fact that the VLCCs didn't make $100,000 a day is what's basically missing. And now we have 46 VLCCs. It gives us a massive potential if that market really kicks off. I think that's basically what this story is missing. To see the big, loaders, steam ahead, you see those $100,000 per day plus fixtures. That's, probably what our investors are waiting for.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. So if you are on Twitter, you constantly see this debate that, you know, the Frontline stock is more expensive relative to peers. And then we can always, you know, bring back Warren Buffett that, you know, price is what you pay, value is what you get. Mm. Is it that simple that Frontline should always have, you know, a premium on the stock given reputation, history, execution? Or should people looking at this market always take a fair assessment on market cap, net asset value, etc., and be very, you know, let the numbers decide and not...
I think if you take our various peers, and you know, and this is what the generalists do, you know, they put everything into a massive sheet. They probably have one model which they just replicate, and then they put all the other our competitors' numbers in there, and then they realize that cash flow per share in Frontline is higher than cash flow per share in another company. And it has to do with cost, and it has to do with leverage. But then also lastly, I think it's like a brand name. You could jokingly say that, when somebody on Wall Street is reading in the Wall Street Journal that Tankers is going somewhere, he will just plug FRO into his Bloomberg terminal. I also think we've benefited a bit more now, basically because of the Euronav used to be a blue chip together with Frontline. It's still a blue chip, but it's not a pure tanker play. So if you want the bang for the buck in the tanker industry, I think more capital is creeping into Frontline. And I must say also, since I am allowed to market Frontline in this show, the interest we're seeing from Wall Street, over the last 6 to 8 months has been tremendous. And it's the generalists. You know, these guys don't really care about shipping. They have absolutely, they don't have any loyalty to any particular industry. What they try to catch is, kind of more bigger cyclical trends, right? And it's actually quite funny when you sit in New York in an investment meeting and, kind of that they have this structure where you have an investment manager, and then you have kind of various investment analysts that they send out to speak to companies, right? The guy will sit there, he's your age or younger, has no idea. You know, when you talk about early 2000s, the guy was not even in uni yet, but his manager told him to go have a look at this tanker industry, because he made a lot of money on that sector back in 2000, right? So, but what we've seen is then, and this is proper money, an inflow of these guys gradually building positions and buying into kind of this supply story, or the lack of supply story, to be quite honest. I think investors can just look at how our liquidity has developed, which is then one thing, kind of the big boys getting positioned into the stock. Secondly, obviously, this effect that Euronav has lost some other tanker investors and probably moved into our company. And then also that when you put Frontline into this very model that doesn't have, you know, there is no subjective, or might be some, but there are very few kind of subjective kind of KPIs in that model. You see that cash flow per share, you get a little bit better rewarded in Frontline than other companies, which obviously means dividend in the end, or can mean dividend in the end.
Definitely. Okay, time is going by super fast. I have some other segments, so let's keep your answers as short as possible.
I'll try.
Even though I love the long answers, to be honest. So if we're going to dive into some fun topics, so do you have any overlooked crude markets that will come in the next 10 years? There's always talk about, you know, Africa, India, but do you see anything that makes you curious, given the future projections?
Most definitively. So India is one. I think people need to look at, and this is just not oil, it's also coal as well and other. You know, there are actually things going on in India. India's demand for hydrocarbons and, in any which shape or form you want to look at, has grown tremendously. You know, this is a hugely populous country, it's comparable to China. They've gone from, you know, being kind of, 3 to 4 million barrels per day of oil imports, now kind of flirting with 5 and north of 5 million barrels per day. I think why people are ignoring India is because they geographically are so close to the biggest source of oil in the world, being Middle East. But we see them source oil, you know, like other countries start to do when their demand reaches a certain level. They need to diversify the oil flows, because you can't run a country on oil from one source. Obviously, they've been tapping into the Russian oil as well, and Iranian oil, but you see them to a greater and greater degree start to reach further out. Then secondly, on the supply side, Guyana is, very few people actually know where even Guyana is. I've actually been there. It's a country that, has found a lot of oil, and it's the same, this is probably why, well, as we've heard, Venezuela are claiming kind of rights to some of that oil, because it's basically the same offshore shelf, if that's the right word, that Brazil sits on and Venezuela also has. So if you put South America and Africa together, it fits. So basically, this continental shelf's drifted apart, but the oil deposits are of similar character. So Guyana as a producer is big. And also lastly, and this is not a supply story on oil, this is more political. I think it's still kind of strange that OPEC are so kind of forcefully cutting production or keeping a lid on production here. And I think kind of the cost to the Middle Eastern countries makes it very difficult to keep OPEC disciplined. So I think that's probably what I would try and follow up on if I was an investor, to look at kind of how is that story developing? You know, how happy are the Saudis by basically subsidizing oil production in particularly US, these days? And I think that's, for me as a freighter of oil, for Frontline, we don't care if the oil price is high or low, we care about the volumes. So, and actually low oil price, high volume is, better for us.
Very good. So from your perspective, the most impressive tanker or shipping company besides Frontline that you've seen and said, that's a quality work.
Yeah. No, I've always liked the way DHT conduct themselves in the market. It's obviously close to home because they're literally our neighbors here in Oslo. But I like extremely disciplined, a bit different than Frontline, but they have a very disciplined strategy in how they work their markets. But I must say, and I probably shouldn't be allowed to say that, but I also like, as a kind of a big marketer of shipping as an industry in the equity markets, is obviously Scorpio. Not necessarily, in all KPIs, but by being kind of a very dynamic and outspoken company. But I think, people have kind of not really noticed what Hafnia is doing. They have a big fleet. They're, specifically into at least what's been kind of the best parts of the markets for the last couple of years. Similarly, potentially international seaways, but they have an older tonnage on the clean side. But I guess I'll have to stop there.
No, that's a great answer. So if you look at the next generation coming up, you also have interns sometimes. You see a lot of talent coming through the system. So what are the most important skills from your perspective you see that this next generation needs to master?
Well, what I've seen, and we do have interns, and we have young people in the office, the skill that, and it's not lacking at all, but the very important skill in shipping is to be outgoing and make friends, be active kind of in getting to know people, because shipping is not a profession you can be in and sit in your cubicle and study charts or read news. You actually need to go out there, and you need to, you need to connect to people, you need to get to know people. You need to travel. Regretfully, not everyone comes to Norway. This is actually not the center of the world. So you need to get out into the real world or the big world.
That's Guyana. You've been there, right?
Yes, and you go to, well, not necessarily that's the most important destination, but I think young people today, shipping is a profession you can't combine easily with, say, being the best on Strava, or having a huge interest for something that takes a lot of time, because most your job is also borderline your hobby, or it has to be, otherwise you probably won't be able to spend enough time getting into the position where you have kind of all these connections, where you get all the kind of unstructured information that makes you able to make good decisions.
That's a great answer. Mm. This is a very hard question, but I'll try to ask it. If you could project yourself backwards and start your career again, would you pair that knowledge you have today with something else, whether that's, human behavior, technology? Is there any skill that you would love to have today that you would, if you started over again, spend time learning? Because I find the best people have a unique combination of several skills, and they put it together and become very effective, if you understand that question.
Yeah. No, I not that it necessarily, hinders me a lot, but I think law has become so important in this industry, and in any industry, really. I'm so old that when I applied for university, going to the university there to study law was actually open. You didn't even need to, you obviously need to apply, but everybody would get in. And I remember the story was that, we have more lawyers in the university than people that are actually practicing law, and that market is going to go, it's going to be, you're going to be an unemployed lawyer when you get out. But how wrong were we, kind of? So I think kind of You know, I did business school. Obviously, you have some classes in law, but you know, if I was going to kind of do all that again, I'd probably spend a bit more time on the legal aspects of things, because it's this is obviously services we need to buy now, but it's become a very important, regretfully, I would say, part of our industry.
That's a great answer. So one new technology that you believe can transform the shipping industry. Now we see so many attempts on decarbonizing shipping.
Mm.
It's very hard to make bets, of course, but have you seen something that makes you curious, whether that's carbon capture, putting sails on the ships again? Do you see any things where you're like, ah, okay, maybe, let's see?
No, it's, I think, and you know, we have a very kind of skillful CTO in Frontline, and he's always said it's going to be a combination of things. And I think that's exactly what we're witnessing. So, you know, you have kind of air lubrication, where you basically blow air under the hull. You have rotor sails. You have carbon capture. I think kind of a lot of these things are going to kind of come together. I think one realization that many people have probably had the last year is that, you know, the green fuels, it's good, you know, shipping is such a small part of the demand side for green fuels, you know, being, for instance, ammonia, that, you know, are we going to get access to it? So basically, you know, yes, of course, having the, you know, the ships are not built solely for ammonia, you know, it's dual fuel engines. So you keep your options open, but are we going to get access to cheap green fuels in the shipping industry, competing with all the other industries that actually, you know, demand the same fuels? So this has probably put people more into the camp where, okay, let's look at all the other options we have. And then obviously ultimately you have nuclear, but you know, and these are the things that where you make small differences. You know, for carbon, you can capture maybe 10% of the carbon you emit. Air lubrication maybe gives you 5% less, you know, consumption. Rotor sails maybe another 5%, and gradually you kind of you get there, at least within reasonable period of time. You get there, but also, you know, I think now that and Øystein is going to hate me for this, but now that you know, LNG is kind of so cheap, you can actually look at that as dual fuel as well. So the case is maybe coming back, but I think it's a combination of things. I don't believe in one single technology, to be quite honest.
Yeah, that's a great answer. So we're running on overtime, so I'll save some of the questions for hopefully a part three in a couple of years. But just the last one, I asked you, do you have any favorite books you can recommend that you either read recently or that you think suits this environment we're headed into, whether that's from investor perspective, shipping, or could be anything?
You did give me a heads up about that question. I must admit, I haven't had time to read anything for the last 18 months to 2 years, at least not in you know, but I'm not going to point out a specific book. Well, actually, I can point out one, and I believe it's called Blood and Oil. And it's about Saudi Arabia and MBS. It's a paperback. I've read it, you know, on the plane. It's not a book he would approve of, but I think for understanding some of the dynamics that are happening in Saudi, it's a good read. Not a particularly long book. But again, I must say, I don't think he necessarily approves of the book. Could be also that it's not necessarily true, but it gives a glimpse into the dynamics in the Middle East, and a very important country in the Middle East.
But maybe also pick up a law book, like you said.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, The Absolute Idiot's Guide to Shipping Law or something like that.
Yeah. Now, let's end it there, Lars. Once again, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it and hope we can do it again in the future.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you like this episode and the content we produce, head over to my YouTube channel. Just type in Christopher Vonheim. See you next time.
All opinions expressed by Christopher Vonheim or his guests on this podcast are only their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Vonheim. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Christopher Vonheim as a specific reason to invest or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.